I'm Lydia, and I'm in Nova Scotia, but I come from Ontario, and I'm a transplant, and I just spent 2 meetings in Ireland today, which was lovely.
I'm Nisha from Philadelphia.
Ah, another Philly. Wonderful. I'm glad to have you with us, Nisha.
Philly from Philly.
And the cat's name?
This is Chara.
Beautiful.
Thanks for sobriety.
Is he sober?
Yes.
Whew, that's important.
Hasn't ever had nip.
Well, it's 2 o'clock my time. Should we start, Joe, or should we wait a few more minutes for people?
Why punish the punctual?
Okay. All right. All right, then. Hi, everybody. My name's John. I'm an alcoholic, and my home group is in Kansas City, Missouri. It's the We Agnostics group. And welcome to our first monthly secular speaker meeting that is going to be hosted today by Secular AA and the International Conference of Secular AA. We are members of Alcoholics Anonymous who seek to ensure that AA remains an effective, relevant, and inclusive program of recovery in an increasingly secular society. If you aren't familiar with the International Conference of Secular AA, we got our start in 2014 with our first conference in Santa Monica, California. At that time, we were known as the We Agnostics and Freethinkers International AA Convention. After that conference, we decided to change our name to the We Agnostics Atheist and Freethinkers International AA Convention so that we could become more inclusive. Then we had a conference in Austin, and we decided to change our name again. And we decided to call ourselves the International Conference of Secular AA. And that's who we've been ever since until we decide to change again. The audio will be posted on the Secular AA ICSA YouTube channel and also on our website. For those of you who need proof of meeting attendance for court or other purposes, we'll provide you with that information at the end of the meeting. Try to keep yourself on mute unless you're ready to talk, and then you should unmute. Also, you should know that this is a monthly meeting, and it's going to rotate from one group to the next. So today, this being the first meeting, we're hosting it. The Secular AA ICSA organization is hosting it. But next month, it'll be hosted by Omegad, the group in Orlando. And then after that, I think it's going to be Montreal. And then we have South Africa. And we're always looking for other groups who would like to host this meeting. So if your group is interested in hosting it, send an email to secularaa@gmail.com and they'll put you on the schedule. Okay, and then you should know that between speakers today, we're going to do a poll asking you some questions. Okay, now I'm going to go ahead and open the meeting by reading the AA preamble, and then I'll turn it over to Joe, who will introduce our speakers. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Joe, it's all yours.
Hi, everyone. My name's Joe, and I am an alcoholic, a member of
Joe.
Hey, everybody. I'm a member of the Beyond Belief Agnostics and Freethinkers group in Toronto, Canada. Have been since 2009. Glad everybody's here. Just by way of introducing our first speaker, history is being changed because of this pandemic. I just want to share something with you. This is something that a delegate shared me. What you're looking at here is the foreword to the fourth edition that was in the 2001 big book. And it said that AA members with computers, can participate in meetings online, sharing with fellow alcoholics across the country or around the world. Fundamentally, though, the difference between an electronic meeting and home group around the corner is only one of format. In any meeting, anywhere, AA share experience, strength, and hope with each other in order to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Modem to modem or face to face, AA speak the language of the heart in all its power and simplicity. Now, the reason there's this little blacked out area is the conference was asked to take that out because some members didn't believe it was true around 2006. Fundamentally, the difference between the electronic meeting and the home group around the corner is only one of format. So if your copy of the fourth edition isn't a 2001 to 2006 edition, you don't have that in there because the conference did as the fellowship asked and took that sentence out of there. And they were future seers because if for any reason it wasn't true then, our first speaker is definitely an example of how that's just not true. Sober since Zoom and someone I've gotten to know mostly from our time in the Ireland group, but I see her all over the planet. Please help me welcome Kim B. from Oregon.
Oh, thank you, good people. It's good to see you today. Now that this is being recorded, I feel compelled to set the stage and let you know what you're in for a little bit. I'm in a small house in Oregon with ridiculous acoustics. At some point, while I'm speaking, my dog is going to bark. That I can promise you. And any of you who have seen me before have become quite familiar with the south end of my northbound cat as she tries to insert herself into the proceedings. So that's all by way of saying that there's a lot going on around here. So I'll try not to get distracted. Let's put it that way. I'm Kim. I'm from Oregon. As Joe said, I quit drinking and I saved my life. I'm 10 months into this sober life, and I have never attended a live or a traditional AA meeting. What I know about the rules, slogans, language, and protocols of AA meetings, I've learned from watching and listening to all of you. At first, as I was attending these meetings, I thought that I was going to be or was called upon to somehow explain what I believe and what I don't believe. But in a meeting recently, where Joe was the featured speaker, by the way, I had this epiphany. I don't come to these meetings to teach anyone anything or to change any minds. I come here to offer only my experience without explanations. And I learn a lot from the experiences, but maybe not so much from the explanations of others. My long-term affair with alcohol began when I was 14 years old. I drank just like my friends did in the farm country in the Midwestern United States, tornado country, as we were talking about earlier before this meeting. Most of our parents knew all about our drinking, and oddly, at least oddly today, they were pretty okay with it. I can remember one time appearing at breakfast with my friend Peggy, and we were feeling like shit because of too much Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine the night before. And Peggy's mother smiled at us fondly over the breakfast table, and she said, "Girls, wine is food." And that was really pretty much the attitude of the parents back in the Midwest, back in those days. Boys and girls would mix it up on the weekends. We would somehow get kegs of beer. We were all underage. I don't remember how we did it, but we'd get kegs of beer for parties that were held out in somebody's back 40 acres. I still have the scars on my legs from hurling myself over the barbed wire fences to get to and from those meetings. Parties. Back then, marijuana was ditch weed, so probably any high that we got was more imaginary than chemical. There were other drugs around, but their use was not very common, and I was terrified of them. my first love from age about 14 was into LSD. And when we got a little bit older, he was calling me and talking to me late into the night while he was high on LSD. He hung himself when we were 18 years old. He left me the suicide note, and I have never, ever touched hallucinogens. I'm really lucky that my immediate family was fully functional. My dad, an alcoholic, just like I turned out to be, was really happy when he was drunk, and he took really good care, financially took really good care of his family. My mother was a good wife. My mother was a good mother, and it was very much her way of separating from literal murder and mayhem in her own family of origin. And she was very good at shielding the rest of us from all of that. When I was 18, I left my family to get going with my own grown-up life, and I moved to Texas. Once I was in the Lone Star State, I spent my nights with tequila and my much older boyfriend. By day, with the help of some prescription amphetamines from a coworker, I was the fastest and friendliest grocery checker in the West. Anyway, it turned out that my much older boyfriend was an asshole. And when I realized that I hated him, I just set out I embarked on a whole different life altogether. I signed up for college. I worked two jobs. I got a degree. And then once I had my degree in hand, I decided that I wanted to live in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, here I am in Texas. I have never, ever, ever been to the Pacific Northwest. So of course, the Pacific Northwest is where I want to live. In college and law school, I drank socially. I think looking back, I kept well within the bounds of what was considered, at least at that time, social drinking. But everybody knows what college drinking is reputed to be, and I would say that's true. But still, I was working two jobs in order to get through school, and I had to keep my grades up for a scholarship. So drinking wasn't yet the wrecking ball that it would become later on in my life. I met my husband in law school, and I drank again. I would say that it was socially. I met my husband in law school. We didn't rush into anything. We were together 40 years, 20 years before we got married in the year 2000. We've now been together 40 years. We both drank, and as our careers took off, the quantities that we drank also increased. And as we began to recognize the increase in quantities, we started imposing the usual stupid rules. I bet you every one of you knows those rules. We'll only drink on weekends. Maybe Wednesdays and weekends. Okay, well, this is a special occasion and blah, blah, blah. The rules that nobody can ever abide by who has a problem with, who's an alcoholic. At first, I drank much less than the lawyers I worked for, and that was mainly because I worked all the time. In my office, if you didn't show up on Saturday, then you might as well not bother showing up on Sunday. I rose in the ranks. I started keeping up with the drinking of my peers and colleagues, although I have to say still I wasn't, at least I wasn't regrettably waking up with my secretary the next morning after the Christmas party. So I felt kind of superior to my drunken partners. And my behavior was, of course, exemplary my drunken behavior at the Christmas parties was exemplary. But I started turning down more social invitations so that I could concentrate on my drinking. And the more I did that, the more that mere blackouts became full-on scary passouts. And these full-on scary passouts scared my husband, and they left me very frequently with racking anxiety. So in 2001, my husband and I quit drinking, and we did it just like that. I loved being sober and healthy. My husband and I agreed that the only drinking that we missed was the fishbowl-sized red wine glasses that our favorite restaurant served. Other than that, we didn't miss it very much. So weirdly, 6 years of sobriety went fantastically off the rails when I got my dream job, of all things. That job required me to travel to the other coast of the United States for a week of training. And when I was at the airport, I spotted the airport bar. And I thought to myself, if as best I can recreate it, how relaxing one shot of my old favorite would be, how relaxing the long flight would be if I just had one shot of my old favorite. I didn't weigh the pros and cons. I didn't, I'm sure, think about it at all. I just ordered it and I shot it down the hatch. And from that moment on, I became a sneaky, secret, lone drinker. I still had enormous responsibilities in my life, both personal and professional. My husband and I never had children, so we had responsibility for the older generation. And that was a responsibility that I loved. Because of this, these responsibilities in my life, I could go weeks without drinking. And in fact, to most people, for a long time, I was still a non-drinker, as far as they knew. But each return to my solitary, sneaky drinking got darker and darker. And I ended up, I'm sure, not fooling anybody, even my cat, probably especially my cat, because I can't tell you how many times I woke up and found that my cat, who hated the drunk me, by the way, had pissed all over me. So she's my little probation officer even to this day. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure when it started that I felt like I would die if I didn't drink. My husband, who never did go back to drinking, one time, not so long ago, asked me, "What can I do?" And I said, "Let me drink. I'm still meeting all of my responsibilities. I'm still taking good care of everybody and everything." But really, that wasn't true. It was slipping away from me. My retirement was right around the corner, and I jeopardized it. I jeopardized my retirement by losing track of days and by drinking instead of working. The very last shameful episode in my career was more than I could bear. And that's saying a lot, because in that many years of drinking, there's sure a lot of really dumb and shameful things that go on. So that's really saying a lot. I went to my doctor and I begged for help. She gave me a scary high blood pressure reading, bad lab results, and a treatment referral. And the probably worst thing about that visit was the fact that she was really angry with me, because in 20 years of visits, I had never once mentioned to her the fact of my binge drinking. I never realized until really late in the game what it was that drinking did for me. And I wouldn't have even been able to articulate it until very recently. And one of the reasons I can do it now is because I'm just starting 10 months in to be able to organize my thoughts around all of this and to be able to talk about it. And what I got out of drinking was that it was a meditation. The first and second drink, and as my tolerance rose, it might have been a little bit more than that, put me really wholly and happily into the present moment. There were so many times that I was, after that first little bit of alcohol, I was so filled with gratitude to be exactly where I was at that very moment. And of course, the rest of the box of wine would utterly demolish that. And the next morning, I rarely remembered being so blissed out when I woke up the next morning, if I remembered anything at all. I'm really lucky that I never did more to myself than fall down the stairs, sprain an ankle, break a foot, wake up with cuts and bruises that I was unable to remember even having sustained. I was mostly safe in my own room with my own box of wine, but I did drive. I would, when I ran out of wine, I would get in the car and I would drive to buy more. And I also drank a nearly lethal quantity of alcohol. Intensive outpatient treatment, which I finished a couple months ago, was rocky at first. The program was straight up 12-step, big book, 12 and 12, and that program very much expected non-believers to fake it until we made it. I almost ran. I almost turned and ran. That scared me. It wasn't for me. I didn't know how I was going to fit into all of that. But fortunately, and I say this sincerely, fortunately, the pandemic came along, and And it opened up a whole new world of secular AA and Zoom to me. So during the treatment, with half an ear on the God bits, I Googled up books and classes and secular meetings spreadsheets. And those are the things that took me where I needed to go. I also fully participated in the non-God bits, mostly having to do with what is now known about addiction and a wide variety of practices to get and remain sober. Fortunately, treatment for me coincided with retirement so that I was able to put all of my attention toward cultivating those practices. I have incorporated principles of gratitude, mindfulness, service, yoga, and character strengthening into my daily routine. And the standout thing for me throughout all of it, and I realize this every day when I see your faces, the standout thing for me has been this one thing, that other people matter in this process. My program is this: I hunt for the good stuff, and I'm grateful. I leverage character strengths. I strengthen connections, and I help others. On all counts, these secular meetings have been an absolute goldmine for me. I've come to understand that if we say that this is an AA meeting, this is an AA meeting, and you aren't going to kick me out. I can disbelieve whatever I disbelieve. I've come to trust you all, and I always look forward to listening to you all. I'm going to wind it up with this. I'm 62 years old. I'm absolutely in awe of the long-timers in these meetings who have years and years of sobriety. I'm also incredibly happy for the youngsters who are here who have the chance to achieve the same. I want to make this clear, though. I don't look back on my my drinking years as wasted years, and I don't look back on my drinking self as a waste of space. In addition to drinking alcoholically, I was depressed, selfish, materialistic, unkind, ignorant, cruel, and too many rotten other things to put all in one list. But I was also responsible, loyal, kind, and I was loved, and I was generous. So I am the sum of many parts and many years, and although I'll never ever be able to peg those many, many years of sobriety, I'm really happy to be where I am right now. I have no regrets. I am deeply, deeply happy in sobriety, and I'm also very, very glad to be on this whole adventure with the likes of you. So with that, from my heart to yours, Kim, over and out.
Thanks, Kim. Everyone, if you want, you can unmute and just quickly say, express your appreciation by all means.
Thank you, Kim. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
Awesome job.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you,
Kim. Awesome.
Thank you, Kim.
Okay, so between speakers,
very good.
I'm going to turn the meeting over to John, who's going to conduct our first ever International Conference of Secular AA poll.
Okay, all righty. Let me see if I can do this. Okay, I got to go down and find poll. Okay, here we go. I've got the poll, and I'm going to launch it, and you can go ahead and have fun with it. Here we go. Ready? One, two, three, launch. Oh, people are answering.
Did you answer the poll? Was it just one question?
And the answer is, who is John F?
We have, I think we have, how many? No, that's counting up. Do we end the poll at any time?
Yeah, you can end the poll if everyone's ready.
If everybody has responded and looks like we have a good percentage of people responding, I'm going to end the poll. Bam, it's ended. And should I show the results, Joe?
Open.
Okay, I'm going to share the results now.
Is, right?
So, what role should ICSA play and the Secular AA org web page provide? And it looks like the number one response of 46.6 or 77% of the people say that it should keep lists of secular AA meetings. 55% say that we should consider more virtual conferences. 53% say we need to have information about how to start meetings and learn about secular AA groups. The next highest one was actually 67% facilitate communication within the fellowship. That's interesting that that was actually the second highest response. Interesting. And just do the biennial conference, keep it simple. Only 5% said that we should do that. And then someone said other, and I don't know what that is. But that's it. Thank you, folks. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, everybody, for participating, because we have our next committee meeting on later this month, and we really don't want to be an ivory tower, committee, right? Like, we really feel like we're there trying to do whatever the collective will of the secular AA community is. So we'll probably do something like this every month and just sort of get some feedback from you. And if there's things that you think would be a good idea, just email us and we'll add it to a poll coming to a town somewhere soon. So our next speaker, I don't have a prop. I don't have like anything from the big book to introduce him. I just had my friend Patrick from Dublin. This meeting could actually be the Irish Dublin Wednesday evening meeting, because a lot of us who have participated have been part of that. But the great thing about Zoom is I'm getting to know people all over the world, and I'm really enjoying that. Declan, where are you? Let's turn it over to you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Declan, an alcoholic, and thanks for having the meeting here tonight. Thanks, John.
Hey, Declan.
Hey, everyone. And thanks, Joe. And thanks, Kim, for the opening remarks. I just thought that was amazing. And something you said really struck with me. And I'd never thought of it like that, about the first couple of drinks bringing you into the present moment, you know. And it reminds me of the power of fellowship, where if you keep showing up, if you keep coming back, you keep learning, you know. And I always want to be teachable. That's my own desire for myself, both now and going forward. I want to remain open to learning, and this program has been all about learning, you know. My name is Declan. I come from Dublin, and I grew up in an alcoholic household, so I'd seen alcoholism from the get-go. You know, I as a child, I'd seen it. And my father was initially the main alcoholic, and then my mother joined him, in later years. And he was violent. So as a young child, teenager, adult, I'd seen police at the door. I'd seen, you know, puke on the floor, you know, the whole nine yards. I'd seen my father hit my mother. I'd seen the whole nine yards. And do you know what came out of that whole experience was a deep desire not to be that. You know, I'm not going to be this person. And here I am at an AA meeting. You know what I mean? So cunning, baffling, powerful, how this disease works. But what came up from that early experience, you know, growing up in that environment, was a child and a young adult, and then an adult who was, you know, deeply mistrustful of the world, you know, deeply suspicious of people, because, you know, it was natural. People told me things and that didn't happen. You know, people said, you know, we'll be there and we weren't there. We'll be home and we won't be, and we're not. We don't come home, or we come home drunk. And, you know, my earlier experience was fearing my father's key in the door, where I'd be in bed and I'd hear the key go in and I'd wonder what we were going to get. So, you know, at a very deep and fundamental level, this boy was going to tell a different story. You know, and it wasn't going to be like that for me. And I remember my mother saying at one stage, and it was something that stuck in my mind, and that's a long time ago, she said, shut that door, close those blinds. In other words, you remain hidden. You know, we don't show ourselves to the world. The world sees the exterior. It doesn't see what's actually happening on the inside. So that was, and I learned how to live by those demonstrations. And I grew up in a society and in a culture which, in modern parlance, would be deeply unskilled. We say that people weren't skilled in how to live a life. They didn't know how to deal with feelings. They didn't know how to deal with problems. The solution to problems for many people was to take a drink. Now, some of us went on to become alcoholics, you know, of one level or another, and that certainly was my experience with my parents. I had a brother, the nearest brother to me, he died very tragically when he was 20, in a motorcycle accident, and that sent my mother over the edge, you know what I mean? So the one parent who was anyway stable was gone. Bring it forward a couple of years, and this person who had no skills, no knowledge of how to live, thought, okay, how can I just get on with life? The one thing I'm not going to do is drink. So I didn't drink really until I was about 19 or 20 when I started work in the 80s, thereabouts. But I had another story going on in the background. So I was hidden anyway, and that was my nature. I'd learned that from as a child. And I was also a gay man in a deeply conservative country. And at that time, a time that when things were changing, but nonetheless, that was the story. And, you know, we were considered, and sometimes are considered, something, you know, with a predisposition to something evil. So as a growing teenager, you know, aware of my own sexuality and my own, the pull of that, I was just deeply conflicted, you know. So it's no wonder, as I look back now, that I started to drink, you know, because at no level was I comfortable in the world. At no level did I feel, you know, I'm okay being me, and I have some skills in which to be that person, and to have that level of self-acceptance. All I wanted was not to be me. I didn't want my life. I didn't want my story. I didn't want what came with who I was. I wanted somebody else's life. And of course, that's just not possible. But there is a way of making that possible in the short term. And that way is to pick up a drink. You don't know what you miss until you find it. And I remember when I started to drink and just feeling that sense of belonging. I never felt I belonged. I didn't feel I belonged anywhere. I had a crazy family, a crazy me. I had this terrible secret that I felt was just so shameful that I couldn't share with anyone. And so I was guarded, isolated, fearful, you know, deeply conflicted. And then I find alcohol. And alcohol, suddenly people are okay. I'm in a world and I can kind of talk to people. I can do what I now know as a spiritual shortcut. I can become that, a little bit like Kim was saying, I can become that mindful person, you know, and you don't know what you don't know. And this is, as I look back on this young person now, from the age I am now, I see there was no other alternative. I didn't realize there was an alternative. My drinking career was very short. I drank for maybe 4 or 5 years. And I had a moment, and I can clearly remember the moment. 3 o'clock in the morning in a nightclub in Dublin where I'd gone out for one drink, and I'm still in my suit from work. And I thought to myself, this is killing me. This is killing me. And whatever I want, I don't want this. I don't want this life. So alcohol, which initially had been a way to freedom, was only an illusion of freedom. And I realized that something had to change. And I had two siblings who were in the fellowship at that time. And I picked up the phone and I spoke the words. And there's a great power in words. When you say something, you actually make it real. You know, there's a magic to it. So I said, you know, I think I might have a problem with drink. And I went to my first AA meeting and going to that first meeting, as it happens, I went to a gay and lesbian meeting, which had not long started in Dublin. And I suddenly started meeting people where the outside matched the inside. They spoke from a place of their own truth. They spoke of how they felt. They spoke of their fear. They spoke of their anger. They spoke of what was going on. And on the wall were the 12 steps. And then, you know, we read how it works. And, you know, and all of a sudden I'm going, wait, hang on, there's another way to live. And then I see the slogans, one day at a time, keep it simple. You know, these things, this too shall pass. Suddenly I had the words, the language to put around a new way of living, a different way of living. And so that was the journey into that. It was like, okay, hang on a second. You know, these are real people. These are people I can talk to about what's really going on. I don't have to hide. I don't have to hide. And that was so liberating, you know. And I'd like to say that it began with that admission of powerlessness. For me, and it's that has been a powerful lesson over and over again in recovery. I don't get anywhere until I first say what the problem is. There's no shifting until I first acknowledge the truth. And when I saw the truth, I could find a route to freedom. It wasn't freedom per se at that time, but it was the route to freedom. So I began the work on the program, and I looked at the steps. I could admit powerlessness. I could admit unmanageability. That wasn't an issue. I knew I needed some power greater than myself, and that could be the AA as a whole. The culture of AA at the time, and to some extent it still is, the culture is that, you know, there is a God, and God is a Christian God or Jewish or what, you know, there's a kind of a concept. And I bought into it purely for the fact that at some sense it made sense to me. It made, you know, I wanted it to be true. I wanted there to be an explanatory power that would say, do you know something? You had a shit life so far. There's a lot of crap in the world, but there is a reason behind it. And there is a power behind that makes sense of all of this pain, makes sense of all of this suffering. So, you know, a belief married to my desire to believe it is a very strong compulsion. You know, it draws me in. So it's almost like a magic. It's almost like, again, like a spell, a God spell, you know. And when I started cleaning house, you know, the fourth step, and you begin to meet yourself. And I remember on my fourth step, and I still have it, by the way, I wrote on the top of it a quote from the Bible, beneath the shadow of his wings shall I rest until iniquity has passed. I wanted that safety. I wanted there to be a God that would keep me safe. And I wanted it more than that. I wanted a rationale for everything, you know, and the power to explain it all, you know, is God, you know, and so that was the journey into that sense of belief and that desire. But it never really fitted with me. And I'm not going to go on and on about this, but just to say that just faded away over time, you know. And another truth emerged for me. I began to think, this doesn't have a feeling of truth to it anymore. I see why I bought into it. I see the need for that at that time, but it has no meaning for me today. The word God has no meaning for me. It's a meaningless expression. That's not to say that I take away from other people's beliefs. I fully respect other people's beliefs, whatever they believe. And that's, you know, that for me is just about a bit of give and take. And it's about the fellowship of each of us as individuals, where we have a right to our own belief and a right to our own minds, you know. So in a sense, the cleaning house, the talking to someone, the telling of the story of me became the way at which I began to settle in some kind of existential way into the body, into the being of who I am. I'd never felt comfortable being me, but then the fourth, the fifth, even the sixth and seventh steps were ways in which I could come to home to myself. So if AA is anything, it's coming home. And it's coming home to who I am and the mystery of what that contains. For me, I don't have a sense of a supernatural being of any sort, but my sense of AA as a spiritual kindergarten, in which there's a place to explore concepts and things that work for me, without ever having to pick up a drink. Now, I'd just say that I had in some frame of mind, I had a notion. I didn't think I expressed this in words, but I felt as if, you know, I'm going to make a deal with the world. I'm going to get sober. And then God is going to look after everything. And it'll all be hunky-dory and Walton's Mountain and Little House in the Prairie. That's how it's going to be. And that isn't what happened. You know what I mean? That isn't what happened. Life kept happening. A year after I became sober, I was diagnosed HIV positive. At that stage, I was told I probably had about 10 years to live. There was no treatment, no triple therapy, none of the treatments that exist today. So there was a 28, 29-year-old guy, you know, I wasn't going to see 40. A lot of my friends had died. And it felt like revenge. It felt like the arrow shot after the retreating troops. I was escaping, and then I got caught by the arrow. And so I want to speak a little bit to that, and that is to say that in my mind, I had that, you know, I was certain I was dying. In my mind, I was certain that there was a certain path. That isn't how it worked out. Clearly, it's not how it worked out. I'm here. You know? So my certainty, that absolute, I know what's going to happen, is not so true. So I began to have a quality of doubt. And I do call it that, a quality of doubt of my own thinking. And I began to see that somehow or other, how I spin the story is very important, you know. And into it, in more recent times, I there's that sense in which I don't know how the world is. The world is deeply mysterious. Life is mysterious. Everything is mysterious. And I don't need to know. But what I need to do is to for me, I want to live a life that's worth living. And I go back to the program and I look at the seventh step, it says, true purpose of living, honesty, tolerance, true love of God and man. And I thought, there's a North Star to hang a life out of. Do you know what I mean? There's a guide I can use. I can just drop the God bit, but the rest of it's fine. Why is honesty so important? For this alcoholic, honesty is important because everything is predicated on seeing things as they are, on an attempt to see that. It doesn't have to be perfect, but there's an attempt to see the world as it really is, not as I would wish it to be. So when I look at what AA refers to as defects of characters, I don't find that expression useful. I use the notion of I had bad habits, my habit of selfishness, my habit of self-obsession, my habit of egoism, my habit of grandiosity, whatever the habit energy was that didn't serve a purpose. Well, like all habit energies, if it is a habit, then I can change a habit. And AA is a means by which I can do that. I can be mindful. I can bring attention to how my days are going. I can look at these unskillful ways in which I live my life and seek to find something that is useful and skillful. And that has been, you know, part of the journey, you know, and it continues to be part of that. Life kept happening. In 2012, I had two strokes. For a year or two after the two strokes, I suffered terribly with depression, brought on by the strokes. I had a catastrophic family situation occur in my family of origin, which literally shattered the family entirely, and it remains that way. In none of those situations have I needed to drink. And I'm not saying that, oh, well, pat on the back stuff. Drink has never been a solution. My sponsor who's here listening tonight, and who I owe a huge debt of gratitude, Annie, always says to me, her words just ring true. They ring true all the time. And she'll say, if you drink, you're going to have two problems. You're going to have the problem you drank on, and then you're going to have the drink. You know what I mean? So, and every time I'd ever considered it, they were the truths that I would hear back. So, as I look forward, I'm going to wrap up soon. My sense of myself has been, it's not been this life of wonder, of joy, of peace, and this great, happy destiny. It's been at times a struggle. But engaging with it in some sense of honesty and some sense of curiosity, what's life like? What's this about? There's a wow in this that I feel I'm living. I never felt I lived. Those drinking times when they weren't living on the bar stools, shouting, talking about something, shooting off some shit. That wasn't living. This is living. And I'm going to finish on this. I've shared several versions of this story, but this is the story I like most. Somebody bought me a book after I was diagnosed HIV positive, and it was one of those daily meditations, and it told the story of a seagull on the cliffs of, Inish something off the coast of Scotland with two little chicks. And she says, come to the edge. And the chicks, answer, no, we shall fall. And she said, come to the edge. And said, no, we are afraid we will fall. She brings them to the edge. She pushes them, and they flew. Now, I would love that were my story. But I've fallen down off that cliff so many times. But I've been able to get back up. So there's a magic in the story. And the magic is hope. But go and ass about face down the cliff. It's not the worst thing in the world, And I'll shut up on this. One of the great gifts of this program is humor. It's to have a laugh. And just even before this meeting started, there was laughter, there was joke, and there was crack, as we call it in Ireland, crack. And that's just, hey, how good can this? This is good. This is good. And whatever life throws at me, I feel I have the confidence in the program. It's not in me. It's not about me. It's confidence in the program and in the fellowship of which you have all held me and supported me, even though you didn't often know that. And that has been the grounding of my sobriety. That has been the grounding of it. The sharing of that, it doesn't get better, really. I say that with all humility. It touches my heart. It touches my heart to say that, because that's deeply true. Okay, thank you.
Again, if you want to join me in thanking Declan, feel free to unmute.
Declan.
Thank you, Declan.
Awesome, Declan.
Thank you, Declan.
Thank you, Declan.
Thank you, Declan.
Thank you,
Declan.
Declan,
I love sharing with you.
Amen. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Declan.
Thank you, Declan.
Thank you.
We have some time remaining. I'm turning the meeting back over to John, and feel free, you're pros here. You know where the blue hand is. If anyone wants to add to this meeting, we'll do a show of hands, and love to hear from you. John has posted our seventh tradition information. Some other people have posted some meetings. Feel free to capture the chat or click on any of those links, anything you want to do. And thank you again to both of our speakers and for everybody for coming Man, it's what a way to start the year. Thank you.
Thank you. It was great.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Well, if anybody would like to share, we do have some time, and just raise your hand and we can do that. I don't think anybody has their hands up right now, if I'm looking at it right. You would think I would know how to do Zoom by now. What's wrong with me? Anyway, hey, I want to thank, Declan? I'm sorry for my ways, Missouri ways there, but thank you for sharing with us. I really appreciate it. And Kim also, I could really identify and relate to your stories. And it was a great way to start my day here. And thank you very much.
And I would just like to say, I see Russell from South Africa is here. We are talking about doing one of these hosted from the Southern Hemisphere. Montreal is going to be hosting one. And if your group wants to host one of our sort of world tour, great. I just saw a show of hands from Cottonwood, Arizona, from my second home group. the Free Thinkers group in Cottonwood. We would love to get your members involved. So just email us at secularaa@gmail.com. And Russell, how are you?
Hi, Joe. Thanks very much. And thanks, John and Joe and Kim and Declan for an amazing meeting. Really good to have you beaming in my home here in Cape Town in South Africa. I could identify with both Kim and Declan's shares. The thing that I liked, I think, is when Kim said, you know, before she came in the program, she felt she now knows she was ignorant. And then Declan said, you don't know what you don't know. And I remember when I went into recovery, when I went into treatment, there was a questionnaire on the form that said, tell us something special about yourself. And I remember I wrote there, I'm cleverer than any of you. And that was when I went into rehab. And fuck, man, I was so thick. I didn't know what the hell was going on in the world. I was half asleep most of the time. But man, I just keep learning every day now, and I don't know what I don't know, and I'm still ignorant. But I'm a hell of a lot wiser than that first day that I walked into rehab. It's a great reminder to have. And again, thanks for putting all of this together, Joe, especially for asking me to come. And yeah, we definitely want to host one of these. I'll put it to the group, and we'll get it sorted out soon. And thanks again for the meeting.
Thanks, Russell.
Very nice.
I'm Lydia from Canada, Nova Scotia, and I have no words to say how I appreciated both those talks.
Mm-hmm.
They're so inspiring, and again, it reminds me why I'm in this program. It's the honesty, it's the openness to express heart feelings. So mm-hmm. Thank you so much. For Kim and Declan, I really appreciated being here for this two talks.
Oh, so Jeb, you've got your hand up.
Yes. Thanks, John. My name is Jeb, and I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. And I appreciate these speaker meetings because they help me to learn things about myself that I otherwise don't look at. And that's a part of the continuous inventory that AA has introduced to me. The thing that really hit me in there was a reference to belonging and not belonging. Because I think that has been a part of my story and what led me to doing various things to try to connect with other people. Remembering, even though I was an agnostic or an atheist through high school, and when I went to Germany to study for a year I was studying organ, and I needed a place to practice. So I looked for a Catholic, I looked for a church that would allow me to practice there. And I got involved in a community in an American Episcopal church there. And I loved the connection I found there, in spite of the fact that I was still in my addictions and so forth. And that led me on to continuing to need a way of connecting. When I finally stopped drinking, put the plug in the jug, when I finally conceded to my innermost self that I couldn't safely pick up a drink in 1978, I did have support for a church I worked for as a musician. But then when I moved away from there, I was really lonely, and someone suggested I check out Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 2 years. And that first meeting was an awakening for me. I finally found a group of people that gave me permission to not drink. And I left there with a book, big book, and with hope that I could learn to be happy, joyous, and free without alcohol, because I drank for the effect produced by it. But I continued this program of Alcoholics Anonymous a day at a time because for the effect produced by it. I do have that sense of belonging, and my responsibility is to try to help others to get that feeling of belonging, of being validated, of being valued and loved. And that's what we do. We're here to encourage one another. So what is it? 72 days, one day at a time, because that's what they told me. I only have to stay sober today and then repeat it the next day. So thanks for being here. And thanks for another wonderful meeting for me on a wonderful day. Bye.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you,
Jeb. Jeb.
I'm sorry.
Oh, Patrick. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Murray. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to agree with what was said. It's so profound that the importance of that sense of belonging, and that is what we can offer each other, and to be aware that we can also, we can experience it, but we can offer it also by exposing, and sharing our own vulnerability and our authentic selves, which are often, hidden behind all kinds of, curtains when we're out in the social world. But here at AA, we can touch that center core self and share it with trust and hope. So I want to express my gratitude for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Patrick?
Thank you. Kim, Declan, fantastic. Two of my favorite Wednesday people, of course, right? And when Kim, I've told you this many times, but whenever you share, I'm like, what's it like? What's the Zoom girl got to say today? 10 months of Zoom only AA. What's AA on Zoom? Tell me, Kim. And I just love the way you express it. And today was just, I hear a little more of your story and get to know you just that much more, and just loved it. Like, so glad you're here. Seriously, thank you so much. And Declan, with your Jewish gods at AA meetings, as if, I wish, maybe they provided a little more. I joke. Man, it's funny, you sent me a message saying, I'm not a public speaker. I'm telling you, buddy, when you're talking, I'm listening. It's that simple. You got so much to say. It's again, I relate so much to that close the door, shut the blinds. Made me think of Peter Gabriel's Digging in the Dirt, like something Gabriel would write, close the door, shut the blinds, right? But yeah, everything was kept in the family. And, I relate so much to that. And, again, our paths are so different. But boy, when you're sharing from where you're sharing from, I hear you loud and clear, I'm fine in my own way. I don't want to, it seems like I feel like sometimes I'm shitting on traditional AA since I've become Mr. Happening in secular, and that's not the case. I had a thought yesterday. I thought, because I was so resistant, like with the whole Catholic school, Catholic high school, by the time I got to AA, I wanted nothing to do with anything. I didn't have a clue that there was a difference between spiritual and religion at the time. But when I started hearing that, I was like, oh my God, here we go, right? But my desperation kept me there, right? Now I wonder to myself, had secular been available, would I have gravitated towards it? And a more important question, would it have saved my life? Because traditional did. I can never, ever take that. Joe, I'll tell you, you know, that that's what it meant to me, you know? And I guess, like, I really need to say that today, that that I can never forget that, you know? And I think it became so ingrained in me that it took me, you know, Joe's my best friend. I would go to Beyond Belief years and years ago, but and think, wow, what a different, what a new conversation, you know, discourse on a variety of subjects or whatever, but coming back to alcohol and never forgetting the newcomer. I heard all of that there, but I never took the leap, you know? And I feel like loyalty, maybe like that family loyalty, kept me where I was, even though I scratched and clawed and hated so many of the things that we were doing in the meetings, from the Lord's Prayer, you know, to the Christ, to the poems that were read that I couldn't stand, you know? So yeah, this has been an interesting and it continues to unfold for me, you know? And when I listen to different voices, it helps me to sort of help unfold that a piece at a time, you know? But I love you, both of you. But man, today I just felt so connected to you, and thank you so much.
Thanks, Patrick. Well, I guess that concludes the official meeting time. So I'll just close by saying thank you for attending, but we'll keep the room open for any socializing and that we might want to do. So there you go. Thank you, everybody. I appreciate it. And I'm going to stop recording now.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, yeah, John. Thanks, John, Joe, and Declan and Kim. Great.
Thank you, John, for sharing. Thank you for the speakers.
I just want to say I'm very grateful to have been at this meeting, and thank you to everybody. It's after 11 at night here, and I'm going to say goodbye because I'm had a busy day, and I'm off to bed. So thanks again to everyone, and really thanks, special Russell. Meeting.
Sweet dreams, Russell. City of Cape Town.
Wonderful, Russell.
Same excuse from me as well. It's Graham here in Cape Town, so I'm off to bed as well. But at least it's not midnight, Joe. Thanks a lot.
Super, yeah, Graham.
Thank you. Night, everybody. I'm also off to bed. See you soon. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Good to see you, Anna.
Bye, Anna.
Thanks, all. Leaving here from California.
Thanks for staying up late and speaking for us. I always love hearing you, buddy.
Thanks, John. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Glad it's over. That's all I can say.